You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Happy anniversary.
This album's celebrating an anniversary.
And isn't it a good album? Hello,
it is.
Sam.
It's, yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Sorry, I just got a bit...
No, it is.
It is,
really.
Hi.
So, take it away.
So, this week we're looking at the debut album by New York hip-hop group The Beastie Boys. Of course, Licensed to Ill, and that was released in 1986, and it's turning 30 years this year. Which is just incredible. Like, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It just makes me feel old. So, the Beastie Boys, they formed in 1980, so quite a while before this record was released, and originally they were actually a hardcore punk group, and they quickly realized that that wasn't working for them and they weren't getting anywhere, so they dropped that idea and decided to become a hip-hop group. So there you go. But in these early years, they also went through a few lineup changes before settling on the classic lineup and the one that we all know, which is Mike D, MCA, and Ad Rock. And basically, what made them decide to embrace hip-hop, aside from the fact that hardcore punk wasn't really their thing, was the success, I guess, of their EP that they put out, which was called the Cookie Puss EP. sorry, I really fucked that one up.
They're just words.
But so they basically, with that, they were embracing underground rap.
You know what? I think they wanted you to mess that up.
Probably. Yeah. I think it's a deliberate ploy to really put, you know, people off. But they basically embraced underground rap and sampling, which was quite a big thing emerging on the scene in New York at the time. And at the same time that they released this EP, this was around 1984, I think, they also became friends with Rick Rubin, of course, a very famous producer, and he was starting Def Jam Recordings at the time. And basically he asked the group if they would be interested in him helping them produce a record, and they basically agreed, which led to the sessions that would produce, ultimately, the Licensed to Ill album. So just looking at the sound of this record and just the whole sound around Def Jam Recordings at the time. So, like I said, they abandoned hardcore punk, but they didn't abandon guitar music fully. And their style of hip-hop on this record is very much guitar-based.
Well, even like the way that they rap, they're kind of yelling at you.
Exactly.
So I think it's definitely influenced their delivery. Yeah.
Very much. It's very heavy, in-your-face kind of thing. And also, a lot of the samples on this record are of classic rock and hard rock tracks. You've got Led Zeppelin samples, Black Sabbath, AC/DC, that kind of thing. And people actually call this sort of rock rap.
Rock rap.
That was like the thing.
Does it really sound that groovy?
No, it doesn't.
Rock rap.
It didn't last, but that was
rocking
kind of a label.
Yeah.
And part of the reason behind that was also Rick Rubin's influence. Because he was really into hard rock and metal. He was actually producing Slayer's album at the time.
Oh, that would help.
It did help. And he actually brought in Slayer's guitarist, Kerry King, to play guitar on this record. So his influence on this kind of rock style and the heavy guitar samples and beats definitely prevalent throughout the record. Within the wider context of hip-hop, this album would fit within the growing sort of classic old-school hip-hop movement out of New York at the time. Run DMC, who were also on Def Jam Recordings, were kind of leading this movement, and they had a lot of crossover success with their album Raising Hell, and the big hit they had was their cover of Aerosmith's Walk This Way.
And that
kind of crossed over to rock audiences and got rap into a different crowd, because it was still an underground genre. A lot of people didn't take it seriously, and it lacked a bit of credibility, particularly among rock audiences.
Like most groundbreaking genres.
Yes, exactly. So Rick Rubin produced Run DMC and also LL Cool J, and there was no doubt that this album was influenced by what Rick Rubin was doing with those other artists, quite industrial beat-driven hip-hop with rock influences and guitar influences thrown in there as well. Yeah.
Something that, where you can hear the city.
Exactly. And, so it was still, I guess, with bringing in the sort of rock influences and samples, I guess they were trying to make this is still a new style of music, more appealing to rock audiences, and to, I guess, make it more commercial sounding. And they also saw that you could have success as a hip hop artist if you did that, because Run DMC had success doing this as well. So, yeah.
Okay.
So we're going to kick off with the opening track off the record, and this is called Rhyming and Stealing, and you will instantly recognize the the opening drum sample. It's a sample from Led Zeppelin's When the Levee Breaks. And this has been sampled so many times. It's one of the most sampled drum beats ever. Mm. And I guess Led Zeppelin's tracks are great for sampling because John Bonham is like one of the best drummers of all time. He's like a metronome. Like his beats are so on point that you don't need to produce beats like that. You can just use John Bonham's drumming.
Yeah, he's got a very good rhythm.
Very good rhythm. Very good. And then the vocals and guitar kick in, and you can instantly hear, I think, the raw edge style of this record. It's a very harsh style of hip hop, very unique to this time. Like, you didn't really hear this kind of thing until much later with kind of new metal, I guess, of the late 90s, early 2000s. And these days, you don't really hear this kind of thing, definitely in the mainstream anyway.
All right.
So,
well, kicking it off.
Rhyming and stealing.
Yeah.
That is the sound of yeah, that was the sound of 1986, everyone.
Yeah. It was a drunk at a party.
Yeah, drunk bar fight. That's what I was saying while I was playing. I'm like,
they're just going to yell straight down the speakers at you.
They're just cutting over each other and be like, nah, I've got something to say. Drop a beat. Who cares?
Interestingly enough, though, the next track you're going to hear is very different from that track you just heard. It's quite, but I must say also, it's a bit of an exception stylistically on this record, Slow Ride. It starts off with a bit of a horn and bongo sample, which is off a track by a group called War from the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
And the track called Low Rider. And the main horn riff kind of continues throughout the track. It sort of drives the song. And then the guitars and the heavy beats of Ryman and Steelin are not present on this track.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a breather, I guess, after that in-your-face kind of vibe. Yeah.
All right.
So this is Slow Ride. It is a bit of a slow ride.
Aw. So you know that parrot from Aladdin?
Iago.
Yeah. So Iago is voiced by like Billy Crystal, and I reckon one of them sounds like Billy Crystal.
If he was a rapper, that.
Got a chicken. I don't know. It just sounds.
That's what
like
it's
that.
All about.
That's what it's all about. Yeah.
You can nice just, comparison.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, come on, like you know, there's an adoring, you know, gross kind of.
I was like,
about it
sounds to me like you're at a frat party and guys start rapping.
And it's bad.
Yeah, that's kind of the vibe I'm getting.
Oh, my God.
School's out for summer, kids.
Let's go to a kegger. Oh, my God.
Anyway.
Sorry.
We're getting sidetracked.
We do respect and love the Beastie Boys, but they're just so much fun.
They are fun. They are really fun. So we're going to continue with this fun party vibe with probably this is probably their most well-known track and their biggest commercial success. Yeah, you got to fight for your right to party. I mean, who doesn't know this track? A massive crossover hip-hop track. It went to number 7 in the Billboard charts, which is a big deal for a hip-hop track at the time. And you can definitely hear that it would have been recorded with rock audiences in mind, with the heavy guitars, the big beats. There's even a guitar solo. And the significance I think it has, or had, on rock audiences is seen in that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame actually named it one of the 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. So there you go.
True, okay.
Yeah, so, and this is like a party anthem.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. Well, get down to it, y'all.
Get down and dirty.
Hope you enjoy.
Here's the...
Oh my gosh, it's still going. Hear that?
Yep. Whee! Lovely feedback going on there. We're going to just keep speeding through the tracks, because why not?
Yeah.
We're on a buzz here. So the next track is Time to Get Ill. And this track is a bit of a sample feast. There are 13 samples on this one song alone.
Sample feast.
It's a sample feast. The most samples on this song.
What type of cutlery would you use in a sample feast? Just
maybe a needle? From a record player? Don't know. Text us in your thoughts.
Yeah, 5395.
What cutlery would you use in a sample feast? But this track is wild. I mean, there's samples. Everyone's on here, from Barry White to Creedence Clearwater Revival to AC/DC. True. Just anyone, really. Get on there. I just don't know whether this sort of... this would be possible anymore, just in terms of getting approval to use that many samples on one track.
Yeah,
13.
Yeah.
And Justin is a... I mean... This kind of hinted at what was to come, though, because on the next record, Paul's Boutique, that's a sampling beast. There's 105 samples on that album alone.
Oh, wow.
And I think that would be virtually impossible to do.
Zero lawsuits.
Well, they got approval.
Oh, right.
To use them, but it was very difficult, very difficult. And I just don't think it would be possible anymore. But also interesting, as an aside, just in terms of how hard it is to get approval to use samples these days, sampling has kind of disappeared from hip-hop on the whole. And more artists are choosing to either produce the beats themselves or bring in guests to feature on vocals or whatever.
Mm.
That's kind of the more common. I mean, you still get samples, obviously, but not to this level.
Do you think that, like, Jay Dilla was, like, one of the last people who based their career on samples?
Definitely, absolutely. And also probably DJ Shadow as well.
Yeah. Because they were operating before the whole streaming debacle.
Yeah. Jay Dilla... he's just the absolute king of sampling, probably, right at the top there.
Lightworks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Donuts is just...
Yeah, Donuts.
31 tracks and all of them made up of samples. Just amazing.
Yeah.
And, Paul's Boutique, which is the album after this, it's like that as well. Just sample after sample after sample. And this track we're going to play now, Time to Get Ill, is kind of hinting where they were going to go next. So this is... yeah, check it out.
What's the time?
It's time to get ill.
What's the time?
It's time to get ill.
So what's the time?
It's time to get ill.
Now what's the time?
It's time to get ill.
King of all kings.
Oh, that was...
Oh, oh, there's more! Suspension! Oh. We could talk over this.
Is this actually like just the outro?
Yeah, this is just the outro. I just love the little
so
interchange of Led Zeppelin and CCR samples there.
That yeah, was yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Down on the corner.
Down on the dance.
Oh. Oh, this is nice.
Yeah, they knew it was actually quite a bombardment.
They're just
so they
wanted
put
to fool people here. You know, yeah. They wanted to fool people with the cookie puss EP.
They got such a good sense
of humor,
though.
And now they want to fool people with the bloody outro here.
That's so...
Beastie Boys.
Oh, they make me smile.
They
this
do,
is
actually.
So nice.
This is nice. Yeah, so this album was a great commercial success. It was the first hip-hop album ever to go number one in the Billboard charts in the States. And in 1986, this was a big deal. A big deal. Because hip-hop had really only been around 7 years, 79 probably. Mm.
So who was operating during that time? Like Grandmaster Flash was like the first hip-hop?
He was
hip-hop.
The first. Well, also Sugar Hill Gang as well.
Sugar Hill
and
Gang.
And Afrika Mambaataa.
Afrika Mambaataa.
And then there were also lots of people, sort of underground DJs and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And then the people on the Def Jam recordings were the kinds of the ones who kind of brought it to wider audience attention, like LL Cool J, Run DMC, and the Beastie Boys. And
true.
Also... probably also KRS-One slightly later, perhaps.
So would you say that 1986 was a big year for hip-hop in general?
Yeah, just for crossing over. And then after that, it would get more wider attention as it crossed to LA with NWA and Dre, and much later on also Tupac, Biggie Smalls.
We all know
Tribe
how that
Quest,
went. Yeah.
And then Eminem much later.
Much
just a little like, brief kind of history.
Oh yeah,
there.
just go between A Tribe Called Quest and then Eminem.
Yeah, exactly. Just miss out everyone in between.
Nothing else happened in between.
So this album and Raising Hell kind of showed that hip hop could be commercially successful and reach wider audiences outside the underground hip hop scene. And it was number one for a long time, actually 7 weeks. Big deal. Mm. And now it's considered also one of the best debut records of all time. Rolling Stone magazine actually voted it the best debut album of all time.
I like the artwork on it.
It's like a jumbo jet.
Yeah.
And it's also considered now one of the best records of the 80s. Q Magazine voted it the 16th best album of that decade, and Slant Magazine voted it the 12th best of that decade. And, I guess this can be put down to the fact that they were a hip-hop group who made such a splash with their debut against kind of all expectations, given the fact that hip-hop was still on the margins of the industry, and these were kind of just three guys who didn't really give a care in the world. It was out there to have fun and have a party.
Well, I think the beauty of them is that they had charisma and a sense of humor.
Exactly, and they
and just
nice, cool videos.
Yeah, but they just didn't really care about what other people thought, and they went on their own way
on their own path,
together.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, though, despite the success of the album, the group would actually go on to better things. Paul's Boutique, which is their next record, is considered their best album. That's the one with 105 samples on it. And also Check Your Head and Ill Communication as well are definitely right up there. They released four great records in a row, really. And for that period, 86 to kind of 94, they were one of the best bands in the world and definitely one of the best groups in hip-hop. No question.
I've seen them live, like back in 2005, I think they came to Big Day Out.
Yeah.
And they were still just full of energy, so like I could only
and
just
they were still making music
were...
right up to Adam's death unfortunately in 2012.
But their live performance and their live attitude was so amazing. Like, it's just cool to see people bring it.
No question. And with that, we're going to finish with the other big hit of this record and another track that was very popular as a crossover hip-hop record, largely thanks to Slayer's Kerry King featuring on this record with his guitar playing. This is No Sleep Till Brooklyn.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Sam.
No worries. Hope you've enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversaries.
No sleep till... I do.
cause he's skeezing with a hole. We gotta say it, get it drunk with money in his bag. We ain't guys in the front and Brooklyn's in the back.
Happy anniversary to that album.
Happy anniversary.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.